For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. Good evening, everybody. I am Aishin Nancy Easton, for those who I have not met. And I guess for those I've met, but you already knew that. We've been experiencing a practice commitment period now for the last 2 weeks, and we've been studying the Bodhisattva archetypes through the book Faces of Compassion by Taigen. And I think I know Taigen has spoken about Manjushri, and he's spoken about the Paramitas. And tonight I'm going to talk about Kanon, or Avalokiteshvara is sort of the overarching Sanskrit name. Kanon is the Japanese name for Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is one of the most well-known bodhisattvas and appears in, I think every Buddhist country. In China, this bodhisattva is Guan Yin. In Korea, Kwan Seum. In Vietnam, Quan Am. In Tibet, Chen Rezig. And the Sanskrit name Avalokiteshvara really means gazing lord, or lord of what is seen. And Avalokiteshvara, and by extension Kanon, is regarded as the bodhisattva of compassion. So you just heard, we just chanted together the universal gateway of Kanzeon, which, and we were talking all about compassion. And compassion is something that I think we could all use a lot more of. But it's so, compassion is so widespread, and there's so many forms that I think for Kanon in particular, or Avalokiteshvara in particular, there are many, many different forms of ways that we can depict this bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara is seen sometimes as male, sometimes as female, sometimes as androgynous. The original form, and actually Taigen has brought in several other additional statues of Avalokiteshvara or Kanon that we can see on the altar tonight. One of which, at least, I can't see the small one, but the large figure here on the front right corner of the altar, I believe is the original form of Kanon, sacred or honorable of Avalokiteshvara. And this bodhisattva has, one face, two hands, looks very much like us as humans, and in general holds maybe a lotus or a vase in one hand, is extending the other. I believe this one is pouring water. And the water, I think the pouring of the water is intended to be sort of a metaphor for compassion, that, compassion really kind of flows through the world wherever it's needed. It's, it kind of pours out of Avalokiteshvara or Kanon, and it just goes where, kind of like water finding its own level. It's, finds its way to wherever it's needed, and maybe low points, maybe in someone's life. Sometimes this bodhisattva is depicted as maybe having a mudra in one hand and extending the other hand in a gesture of compassion. Or encouragement, but there are other forms of Kanon. Another one is on maybe I got my left and right mixed up before, but it's on the left front corner of the altar. I think that is intended to be thousand armed Avalokiteshvara. You may have seen, this is one that has just a few arms, but it looks like each arm is holding a particular implement or tool. I think Kanon sometimes holds, you know, Dharma wheels or malas or swords or mirrors or lotuses or books. And this kind of depicts another quality of compassion in that you can use lots of different tools in the service of compassion. And there are other, you know, really illustrious versions of thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, where there are just arms sort of emanating from off the side and the back with sometimes, you know, maybe 40 on each side, which are supposed to sort of represent the thousand. And each arm has a hand, and each hand has an eye in the middle of the palm. And the eye is supposed to signify the ways in which, you know, Avalokiteshvara is always looking and always reaching out to help. Each hand has an eye so that it, I think, maybe can be more skillful in the ways that it reaches out to help living beings. Not depicted here, but another very popular version of Kanon that you may have seen, and you may have seen if you've been in the Dokusan room, but this particular figure is so fragile that we tend to like to leave it sort of where it is. 11-headed or 11-faced Kanon. You would see this version of the Bodhisattva with, you know, kind of the main face, and then two faces off to one on each side. And then there's another layer, you know, where there's a face and then two off, one on each side, and then another layer. So you got 9 heads, and then there's another layer on the top that's just one single head. And then there is, at the very top, it's kind of capped with the head of Amida Buddha. And some of the front faces are generally smiling. One side tends to be sort of grimacing, and another side is sort of, you know, wrathful looking or sort of fear inducing. And I think the multiplicity of faces is sort of intended to depict sort of the multiple ways in which this bodhisattva can help beings to wake up. Some beings respond to overt kindness. Some beings don't. You know, some beings, it takes more than overt kindness to really get their attention. Sometimes you got to yell. Or, you know, they need different ways to be awakened. And so this is another aspect of the skillfulness of this bodhisattva. In the back, on the wall, and I'm actually going to pass around a lovely sculpture of this bodhisattva that I found online today, depicted on the wall is a version of Kanon called Ichi-yo Kanon, which means Ichi is one, Yo is leaf, and so it's one leaf Kanon, and it's a version of Kanon who depicted usually on water, riding a single lotus leaf. I'll pass this around because I just love that picture. And there is a sort of a famous, you know, mythological story of Dogen when he went to China to really study, you know, Zen and Chan in China. He was there, and then he came back, you know, was returning from China when his boat was kind of damaged during a storm, and there were, you know, the story that they didn't know if they were going to make it, the boat is kind of wrecked, and a vision of Ichi-yo Kanon appeared on the water out in the distance, and they, you know, used this as a way of sort of guiding themselves and were saved. So I don't remember if the story is told in the on that particular print, or I'm not sure what it says on the print.
There's a saying that's supposedly in Dogen's handwriting talking about each leaf being a Buddha, each petal of
Buddha. Oh, okay.
Being a Buddha. The part of it is he was chanting the chant that we just did in Japanese, and
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to get into that in a minute, but and actually, I could use a chant book. Thank you. In, oh, let's see. So I'll just say that, I'll say a little bit more. There are other manifestations of kanon that I... One is called Unfailing Rope, or Lasso Avalokiteshvara. And this aspect of Avalokiteshvara embodies the unfailing power of the Bodhisattva, capable of saving even the most difficult, incorrigible creatures steeped in resistance to wholesomeness. Using his rope as an implement, Fuku Kenjaku Kanon captures and tethers beings until he can bring them to the other shore of liberation. So there are lots of ways of being compassionate. Where was my another one that I really liked was horse-headed Avalokiteshvara, who appears as a fierce, wrathful figure, usually with a horse head depicted in his headdress and with three faces and six or eight arms. And this is another version in which Avalokiteshvara expresses compassion with an angry or terrifying face for whoever needs that in order to awaken and be helped. So there are lots of different manifestations of Avalokiteshvara, as I was saying. One that I do want to touch on, though, is the version that we just chanted in chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra, the Universal Gateway of Kanzaion. Kanon, or Guanyin, as I was saying before, the name means perceiver of sounds, but Kanzaion is slightly different meaning. It means regarder of the cries of the world. And you hear in this passage, it kind of repeats over and over again, you know, by mindfully invoking Kanzaion's power, the billowing waves cannot drown you. And this version of this way of thinking about maybe Kanzaion is as a means of, developing a sense that there is something out there, that there's a being or a force or something that's able to hear all the cries of all the different living beings and can, respond skillfully. I think one of the lines that really stands out for me always in this passage is, in every land, in all directions, in no realm does Kanzaion not appear. In all the various evil destinies of hell beings, hungry ghosts and animals, the sufferings of sickness, old age, and death, all are gradually erased by Kanzaion, whose true regard, serene regard, far-reaching wise regard, regard with compassion and loving kindness is ever longed for, ever revered. And I think this really has a nice way of speaking to something that we often can really feel when we're in a lot of distress or a very difficult situation, just wanting to feel like, somebody hears us, somebody knows that we're out there and we are not so alone. It's a way of reminding us that we're here with others. So, I think we can think of Kanzaion, and maybe, as Westerners, we sort of tend to rely on our own power, and we have a tendency to think of Kanzaion as an internal force, that, by chanting this and by invoking Kanzaion, we can, invoke our own sort of internal compassion or awareness of compassion, and we can calm down, and we can maybe extend a little more kindness to ourselves and to others around us. But I think it's also possible and important to think of Kanzaion as an external force, as, literally depicted in this chapter as sort of this, external source of mysterious assistance and guidance. And you know, I think in a lot of cultures, and in Pure Land Buddhism in particular, there's really much more of a recognition that we don't do things entirely by ourselves. You know, in Pure Land Buddhism, in fact, they really recognize that it's impossible to do anything on our own. And that's, you know, kind of part of the importance of Amida Buddha is, and sort of invoking Amida Buddha is a way of, you know, getting some assistance. So, you know, one question that we can think about in our practice is, you know, how can we learn to trust and rely on this sort of spirit of compassionate regard in the world? We were talking yesterday during the PCP discussion about practice commitment period discussion about, you know, what does it mean that there are different kinds of bodhisattvas, and how are bodhisattvas manifesting in the world? You know, when someone just randomly, you know, offers you some kindness on the street, is that, you know, a manifestation of the bodhisattva? My husband was in a car accident yesterday that was pretty terrifying to him, and he got out, and the driver pulled over, and I won't share the whole circumstances, but the driver got out of the car, and there were extenuating circumstances in this that the other driver had seen, and they both got out of the car, and, you know, my husband was just sort of saying, you know, oh, I'm really sorry, I couldn't help it, I had to hit you, and the other driver said, are you okay? You know, that was the first thing out of his mouth was, you know, are you okay? Are you, and he looked at him, he said, you're not okay. you need to sit down. You should really, you know, just let's just sit here for a minute. And, you know, when we've all had those kinds of examples in our lives, and someone just, you know, they could respond in a way of like, you know, what did you do? You just hit my car, and you know, they're concerned, and they are able to, you know, express concern and offer some compassion and calm, and you know, it's hard to trust that that's coming our way, because so often it doesn't feel like that's what we get. But I think it's, you know, part of practice is learning to, you know, kind of engage in a little bit of give and take with the world, of extending compassion and receiving compassion. And that actually brings me to thinking about some of the qualities that are associated with Avalokiteshvara or Kanon. Because although Kanon is the bodhisattva of compassion, compassion is not really one of the paramitas. You know, we were talking about the 10 paramitas, and there are, and the skillful practices, basically practices that help us to awaken, such as generosity or ethical conduct or patience, wisdom, meditation, knowledge, powers, skillful means, effort. And none of these are compassion, which I always found really kind of surprising. Where does compassion come into this? So there are several paramitas that are associated with Kanon. One would be generosity or dana paramita. Another would be upaya or skillful means, kshanti or patience, and balas or powers. And I'll talk about these individually in a minute, but it started to bring up the question for me of, you know, what is compassion? I mean, literally, we know that it means suffering with someone, and someone, I guess, or something, but just, you know, suffering with. And, you know, I think it does require some particular qualities. I think it requires, when you think about, you know, How do you summon compassion in your life for a person or a situation? I think that it requires some willingness. You know, so you have to kind of give yourself to the situation. You have to be willing to open your heart a little bit and let that situation touch you a little. It requires, I think, some patience to be able to, you know, sit with a situation and let it unfold, and without, you know, kind of trying to push it away if it gets too difficult or grab onto something else. I think it requires some commitment to hanging in there and being with a difficult situation. And I think it requires some endurance. And so compassion requires us to, you know, give something of ourselves. I was just saying a moment ago about learning to, but practicing with trusting our environment and trusting, you know, that we can sort of give and take compassion, and we talk about in our meal chant in particular, the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. You know, that if we can allow ourselves to open up to the world a little bit, we can allow, you know, experiences to come in and compassion to come to us. We can also open ourselves to giving some compassion, and we can, you know, when we feel gratitude at having received, we tend to start to feel much more generous, you know. So it really can become more of an uninterrupted circle if we want to practice with that. So generosity, I think, is really an important part of compassion. Also for Avalokiteshvara, I was talking earlier about, you know, the different arms and with hands and eyes and holding different tools. And I was mentioning that was an aspect of skillful means. That skillful means is really, our ability to offer an appropriate response to any given individual particular situation. You know, there's no one single right way to respond, and even our response to situations often needs some refinement. You know, we may try to, you know, sit with a situation and listen and think about what would be helpful, and then we try to act, and even as we act, we have to observe the ways in which you know, our actions hit the mark, and you know, maybe it didn't quite hit the mark, and we have to think about, you know, we're acting right now, but what are the, you know, maybe the future implications of our actions? So there are a lot of things to consider in skillful means. But this is a quality that I think Avalokiteshvara or Kanon expresses nicely, is that possibility of continuing to listen, you know, hear the cries of the world and hear what needs to happen, but then continue to think about, you know, reflect on how to respond skillfully. I think I mentioned patience, and patience, I don't know that I have a lot to say about it. I think it's that patience is all part of that process, just the patience to be willing to sort of stick with that process. But I did want to say something about powers. Powers are associated with Avalokiteshvara. We talked about, you know, mindfully invoking Kanzayon's power, all these different things that could happen, you know, like the sun you would hang in the sky, or the billowing waves can't drown you, you know, their hearts will be turned to compassion, their weapons will shatter to pieces. So Kanzayon is attributed with a lot of powers, and you know, these are traditionally, I think, you know, sort of supernormal or supernatural powers, like the ability to see the future, or the ability to see past lives, or to radiate heat or light, or to read minds. But you know, powers don't have to be extraordinary. I think if you, each of us is capable of some powers. We have some ability to have some agency, and maybe you have things that you're, you know, particularly good at, like, you know, reading or speaking, or, you know, I think just sometimes the ability to withstand suboptimal conditions is a good power, then, which also takes patience. But that's, I think, part of how Kanon can manifest in the world through skillfully applying powers to different situations. But I think the most important powers that is attributed to Kanon or Kanzaion is really just listening. Just listening sounds so simple that it hardly really seems like a power, but it's actually an incredibly powerful thing. And, you know, some people do this in their jobs, but I think we all need to be able to do it in our lives with others. And so I think it's worth devoting some, you know, kind of time and thought to reflecting on, you know, how do we practice listening to the cries of the world? Cries of the world are coming from lots of different places. I would start by saying that, you know, I think it helps when we can, a phrase that has come up a lot in some of the mental health work that I do is listen non-judgmentally. We need to be able to not completely give up our judgment and our own thoughts and our own position, but we need to suspend that long enough so that we can let someone share their story. It's very powerful to just be able to offer to someone, you know, do you want to talk about something? And just be present and listening to it and not interrupting and allowing the other person a space in which to be heard and to regard each person as a subject in their own right, someone who has, you know, their own perspective, and then maybe continue to reflect on how we can be helpful while we're listening. I think this is especially important when we are the ones who have caused pain. You know, that does sometimes happen, that as much as we would like to be helpful, sometimes we've missed the mark, you know, and we've caused someone pain, and it's very hard to listen in that situation. When you're kind of on the receiving end of, you know, anger or hurt or disappointment, and I think sometimes that's a good time to invoke Kanzaion, you know, in your own life, so that you can find a way to calm down enough in order to listen. Maybe needing to, sometimes we need to forgive ourselves, sometimes we need to forgive others, and just to be able to use that compassion, patience and generosity to be in that moment and try not to run, you know, without running away or defending ourselves, can be very powerful for ourselves and for others. I think sometimes we need to listen to our own cries, the suffering beings that are sitting on our own cushions, and, you know, I think it's helpful to use the image of Kanon as a way of, you know, offering some soothing to parts of ourselves that sometimes feel wounded, you know, pouring some of that water of compassion out so that we can feel a little bit refreshed. And sometimes, you know, we can just sort of listen to sounds that are always available in every direction. We sit here on Irving Park Road, and sometimes we get the sounds from the street coming in, and every once in a while, you know, an ambulance or another siren goes by, and I always use that as a reminder to myself that really any time you hear a siren, it means that somebody's suffering somewhere and that someone is responding to that suffering. And I think that that's that's a nice, that helps me to sometimes just remember to sort of open up and soften and reflect on, you know, the bigger picture of my life. For a little while, years ago, part of my practice was bowing every time I heard a siren, just as like, okay, thank you. Someone is responding. Just as a reminder that, you know, there is that ability to respond. And I think it's, for me, it's always especially inspiring when I hear other people or other beings responding to suffering. I always find it to be an encouragement. It makes me want to open up and respond more. So, you know, we can hear the sounds, we can acknowledge them, and then we can just sort of return. I will say that, you know, our ability to listen compassionately and non-judgmentally as much as we can, I think, can really contribute to our ability to respond appropriately in the world. You know, and that after acting, we may need to continue listening and reflecting. We can't just apply compassion as a strategy. I want to touch on something that I think is important, which is the difference between compassion and just being nice. Compassion is often nice. And I think that, you know, that is the side I prefer to err on personally. But I think we also sometimes need to act in the world. And part of compassion sometimes calls upon us to prevent harm that's being done or speak out about harm that's being done. And that, I think, is, you know, where I find some inspiration from some of the other manifestations of Avalokiteshvara, some of the more wrathful or, you know, the unfailing rope that's dragging, you know, beings. You can't just allow situations of abuse or you know, violations of you know, decent human conduct to continue under the auspices of, you know, we're just being compassionate. I think Pema Chodron calls that idiot compassion, and we do need to sometimes act, but we also really need to act skillfully. And so after acting, we need to continue to listen and reflect and see what the results of our actions have been, and especially if we're acting in a situation that stirs up a lot of powerful feelings and that feels like it's kind of, you know, veering from compassionate listening, we need to then really just continue to practice and pay attention to what we're doing. So I think I think the other thing that is really important with listening compassionately is that we really also need to listen to the perspectives of others in order to discern a skillful response. And so it's so we've kind of come full circle to, you know, giving compassion, receiving compassion, but also paying attention to our own motives and the results of our actions, but also listening to others about the results of our actions and how we can work effectively together. Our limited human perspective is always limited. And I think it's really partly through the strength of getting multiple perspectives that we are really able to be more of a force of compassion in the world. So that's actually a really good segue into stopping and maybe having a discussion about from all the multiple perspectives in the room, about kanon or about compassion or skillful listening or anything anybody would like to comment on. But I conclude. I don't know if anybody has an example of skillful listening or a time when you felt like someone was listening skillfully. Jamie. Okay.
I was thinking about you're kind of drowning out compassion for others and compassion for self, and these kind of two very, very different energies in some ways, or focuses.
Can you hear her over there?
I think that's a really good point to highlight that, or a question, you know, of how do we practice compassion for others without giving up compassion for ourselves, we can't really separate self from others, and I think our compassion might miss the mark for others if it didn't include ourselves. But I think also what your kind of remark made me think of is the way that we are sometimes encouraged to overgive, you know, and then get burned out and or just to get burned out because we've given more than we legitimately have out of compassion, but then we're feeling depleted and maybe, you know, I don't know that there's one right answer. Maybe there's a dynamic balance for working out, you know, how much can I give before I start to recognize that I'm needing compassion myself. Maybe other people have experience with that. It did, yeah. But I'm like really kind of just sort of entertaining the question. We do listen to the cries of the world as they are manifesting through our thoughts and sounds that we hear and our own awareness. But I'm less clear on how it would be having our own cries heard by the world. It's certainly our own cries heard by us. It's all right there. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'd be really curious to hear how he kind of elaborates on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're just there for them. And in a sense, I become invisible in a way. And I'm just there for them to talk about listening and just being with somebody. And at that moment, that's what is appropriate. And it's not about my cries being heard or, you know, my stuff being heard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just being with them. And then there'll be another time later on when I'll go to a supervisor or I'll go to somebody and say, hey, you know, this was really tough. Yeah. And then it's appropriate for our cries. But I think, for me, what happens when I get in those situations with people who are facing the greatest transition you can have in our lives, is just to be there with them. Myself kind of disappears, in a way. It's just to be there with them, not for them, but with them. I think that's important. So it doesn't have to be both at the same time. It could come at different times. And I think that's something we have to be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
There's a time for us to talk about an appropriate response. Appropriate response is to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, hey, Asian, I need your shoulder. And there's one thing, though, you remind me about listening, but that's a hard thing for me. I'm not a good listener in many ways. In some ways I am, some ways I'm not. But somebody remarked about the Dalai Lama, and he said, what really impressed them about the Dalai Lama, they never felt heard so much in all their life, that this man really heard them, that this man really got them. And I think that's part of, and he is like the embodiment, of compassion. He's there for people, he's hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the
I would even go a little bit further and challenge you about whether your self really disappears, or if your self is partly just that interaction, that you're still there, but your maybe laundry list of things you got to do later is not in your mind, but your self is still there. As in the way that we're all bigger than our laundry lists. That person is bringing out a different part of yourself right in that moment. Suzanne, thank you.
The small self might not be there, but in that small self being not a necessary part of that moment, then that gives room for the arising of the larger self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can always go pick that up later. Yeah, I think that's true, and our larger self is so much more connected to all of the beings around us and all the cries that we hear. That's one of the things about sound is, if you really just sort of, I've done this for a period of Zazen, you just sit and you pay attention to the sounds, your head just starts to feel so much bigger. It's like, is that sound out there, or is it in here? Is it both, So the ways in which we are with other people, I think, is it does transcend our smaller self.
And that's how Zazen hears us.
Okay. Well, you got your answer. Through that version of me.
So maybe it's time to formally end, but we'll keep listening. So we'll close with the four Bodhisattva vows.